Okay, so I'm going to talk about linguistics, the scientific study of language. I'm going to focus on two particular areas. One is, as in the title, the relationship between language and society. Then I'll talk a bit about the relationships and the connections between language and thinking. But before I do that, I want to talk about a couple of points to do with English. I'm going to get you to do some work in this. So it is not just me speaking, just you doing some work as well. Okay. Can I suggest if you are not muted at the moment, please mute yourselves for the next few minutes, okay? I'm going to ask you to unmute at the relevant point, but okay, I'm going to begin by talking about some of the sounds of language, and in particular these two English words, pin and spin. Nothing specific about these words, and I could take pot and spot, and it's also to do with the what is shown by the in the spelling by the P, but I could have taken words with T in like top and stop, but we'll stick with these two words, pin versus spin. Okay, having made sure you're muted, can you just put your fingers a couple of inches in front of your mouth and say pin? Okay, you should notice that there's a little puff of air on your fingers, and what happens is that the air sort of builds up in your mouth and then it's released when you pronounce the P sound. Okay, now put your fingers in the same place and say spin, and unmute if you wish to answer. What do you notice with spin?
Paul, there's no blast of air on the spin.
That's right, there's no puff of air on spin. There is on pin. There are a very few number of English speakers who don't get the puff of air on pin, but overwhelmingly most speakers do. Okay, so the two sounds in pin and spin, they are different sounds, yeah? But crucially, they never contrast with each other. So there are no two words in English where one has the sound in pin and the other has the sound in spin. Okay, let's go on and look at some terminology. The puff of air is called aspiration. It's related to words to do with breathing and so on. The P in pin is aspirated. The P in spin is unaspirated. And they are different sounds. You can't hear the sound, hear the difference without some special training, but you can feel it with your fingers and you make the contrast many times every day. So they are different sounds, but crucially, the two versions of P, they never contrast with each other in English. So the P of pin contrasts with B in bin, T in tin, K in kin, S in sin, and so on. But the two versions of P never contrast with each other. That's not true in all languages. In Chinese, for instance, aspirated and unaspirated P do contrast with each other, but not in English. In English, they occur in different contexts. S at the start of a word and, sorry, P at the start of a word and aspirated P at the start of it, unaspirated after the initial S. That's what enables them to be spelt with the same letter, that they never contrast with each other. Okay, so two different sounds which are related to each other, but in a particular kind of way. Yeah. So we've seen two aspects of the study of speech sounds then. One is phonetics, and that's the study of the organs of speech, lips, tongue, teeth, various parts of the roof of the mouth and so on, and also how speech sounds are transmitted and understood. And nowadays, there's a lot of instrumental phonetics dealing with the properties of speech waves. And connected to phonetics, but rather different, is phonology. And phonology is the study of the sound systems of languages. So looking at, for example, the way that the two varieties of the P sound are distributed in English. And also the fact that in English, for instance, we have consonant clusters, things not just spur, but spr and str and cr and blur and things like that, which not all languages have. Okay, let's move on to look at another aspect of language, namely semantics, the study of meaning. I'm going to show you shortly four English sentences, and one of those has a slightly different meaning from the other three. And I want you to decide for yourselves which one that is, and then try to explain what the difference in meaning is. You can explain this in any terms you like. I'm not expecting a technical vocabulary or anything, but just think about what the difference in meaning is. So the four senses are coming up. I'll try to pronounce these in as neutral a way as possible. Okay. John left the meeting when he got angry. One. Two. When he got angry, John left the meeting. Three. He left the meeting when John got angry. Four. When John got angry, he left the meeting. Think for a few seconds. One of those has a different meaning from the other three. When you think you can explain what that is, please unmute and answer.
Paul, I think it's three.
Number three, yeah.
You're talking about somebody else other than John.
Yeah. Sentence three, that he cannot be John. In the other three examples, he could be John, but need not be. Yeah. I hope everyone can agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the interpretation of pronouns depends very much on, well, on things, in this case, the order and the difference between a main clause and a subordinate clause, yeah? So I hope that's made you aware of a couple of facts about English that you did know but didn't know you knew, if you see what I mean, yeah? Okay, let's move on to the main topic of this talk, namely the links between language and society. And this is known as either the sociology of language or else as sociolinguistics. And there are two parts of this, the sociolinguistics of language and the sociolinguistics of society, as they're sometimes called. The sociolinguistics of society, which I'm going to talk about shortly, that deals with things like language planning and the status of languages. But I want to begin by talking about the sociolinguistics of language. And the main focus of this is variation. Not everyone who speaks a language speaks in it in exactly the same way. And there are lots of ways in which language varies. I mean, a specific individual language varies. So it may differ in terms of locality, for instance, obviously geographically based variation. So there's often a contrast made between standard and non-standard varieties of a language. And in the case of English, the standard pronunciation, which is what you will hear generally on the BBC newsreaders and so on, and what non-native speakers are taught at school and what is codified in dictionaries, the standard pronunciation of English is received pronunciation, or RP. The opposite of standard, by the way, is non-standard, not substandard. And there are many ways, of course, in which non-standard pronunciations differ from the standard. So just to give four example words here, there's up versus up, class versus class, sing versus sing, and better versus better. And different people will pronounce those in different ways. So variation by locality, different geographically based accents. There's also variation in terms of sex or gender. This is a bit of a minefield. I will just say, basically, that women's speech tends to be more standard than men's. I'll look at some examples of this coming up. One suggestion is that women are more concerned with their social status than men are, but we'll not go into that in any detail. Yeah? People also vary in terms of their status. The sociolinguistic literature uses the term class, but we use that rather differently, so I'll talk about status instead. And generally, the higher up the social scale you are, the more standard your speech is going to be. Yeah. So, the posher you are, the more education you had, the more likely you are that you will speak something closer to standard English or whatever. There's also variation by age. So many teenagers speak very non-standard ways, but become perhaps a bit more standard when they grow up, if they do grow up and get responsibilities and so on. There are also differences of what we can call ethnicity. Black English and white English are sometimes very different. And Black English is not a single entity. There are lots of variations within it. But just to take one example of Black English, in standard English, when you use an adjective, you have to say a verb to be. So they are sharp. And in the future, they will be sharp. But in some varieties of Black English, you don't have to have the form of B. So you can just say dem sharp or dem wi sharp without the B. Yeah. Many other languages have something similar, but Black English is the only variety of English which has that, I think. And variation in terms of situation as well. So depending on who we're talking to, whatever, we will speak in different ways. So we will probably speak in a more standard way when we're applying for a job than when we're talking to our friends. Might depend on what the job is, but that's true, yeah. And also, written language tends on the whole to be rather more standard than spoken language, again, varying depending on the speaker, etc. So there's a great deal of variation which takes place, and English is not a single entity, of course. Yeah, one particular example of variation is the dropping of H at the start of a word. So instead of so saying av or als or hospital and so on, yeah. And I think we could probably agree that the higher up the social scale you are, the more likely you are to use the H. Women H drop less than men. In a more formal situation, you're more likely to use H's than you would, as I say, when you were chatting with your friends in the pub or whatever. Yeah. And another example I want to look at is roticity or rhotic R, rhotic accent. That's to say the R which is used after vowels, post-vocalic after a vowel. So people who say art, dirt, form, etc., that is a rhotic accent, post-vocalic R. This is not the R after in front of another vowel, so a word like factory doesn't really apply. It's after a vowel, but in front of a consonant, or perhaps in front of a, or before the end of a word. So, for example, some people will pronounce the R at the end of far only when it's in the context, such as far than near, putting the R in there. And another example would be intrusive R, where R doesn't even occur in the spelling. So instead of saying ma and pa, you might say ma lum pa with the R added in there. Yeah. I'm going to come back to roticity and post-vocalic R in a minute. Generally, when people are speaking in a more formal context, they will try to speak in a more standard kind of way. And one thing which sometimes happens in this is hyper-correction. That's to say, people correct their speech and go, as it were, too far beyond what the model they're trying to imitate would say. So if you normally say have, you might want to say have when you're trying to speak in a more formal kind of way. But people sometimes overdo it. And instead of saying their everyday speech might be, I'll have an avocado, but they want to put the H in, but they're not quite sure where it should go. So they may say, I'll have a avocado, even though in standard English, avocado doesn't have the initial H. The word hypercorrection here is simply an observation, a description. It's not in any way just criticizing or poking fun at people who say this kind of thing. Right, and I want to go on and look at particular examples of post-vocalic R. I take it most people here are old enough to have heard of the Beatles, yeah? Okay. If we look at what was happening in British popular music in the 1960s, when people were beginning to, you know, have special Liverpool-based sounds and so on, and British popular music was becoming more popular, they were, the prestigious version of English really was American English. Now, many American English accents are rhotic. They have the post-vocalic R. New York accent does, York, for example, yeah? But most American musicians and singers did not have post-vocalic R, since most Black and Southern US accents don't have post-vocalic R. However, when British musicians were trying to sound more American, trying to sound like what they saw as the prestige varieties, they often copied what they saw as the prestigious version, namely using post-vocalic R. So this is not me, this is somebody else's research, and listening to Beatles LPs is called research, by the way. On Please Please Me, this is the whole album, not just the one song, the Beatles use post-vocalic R 47% of the time. So they're trying to imitate, in a sense, the wrong model, what they see as the American pronunciation, even though American singers didn't on the whole use this. But even then, they didn't quite get to half the numbers of post-vocalic R that they, quote, should have done. But as the Beatles became more popular and as British musicians became more popular, the use of post-vocalic R reduced. So by Abbey Road, only 3% of possible examples of post-vocalic R actually had the R in them in Beatles songs. And somebody else, Cliff Richard, again, that should ring bells. His song Bachelor Boy, with the chorus, "Until then, I'll be a bachelor boy." Now, Cliff didn't have a rhotic accent himself, but when he sang Bachelor Boy, he did. Apparently, he consistently pronounces it Bachelor Boy. But it actually goes further than that. He puts the post-vocalic R there in at the end of the indefinite article, A or A, and sings, "Oh, Bachelor Boy." No American speaker would have post-vocalic R on the indefinite article. So that was an example of hyper-correction, correcting things in what you see as the prestigious use, but actually overdoing it, using R where no American speaker would use it. And if you want to go and listen to Cliff, you can do so if you like after I finish speaking. Yeah? Okay, another example, Australian English. Australian English is basically an example of Southern British English. So Australian speakers don't sound like speakers from Birmingham or Newcastle or Glasgow. They sound more like people from London and the southeast of England. And many Londoners, people from Essex, etc., frequently H drop. They drop the H's in things like ad and hospital. But Australian English apparently doesn't drop H's. There's no H dropping in Australian English. And it's been suggested that this is a kind of people wanting to imitate the prestigious version and doing it very consistently. So what's called leveling up in this case to the posher, more standard version. So I guess if Australians want to talk about Hobart, they talk about Hobart and never talk about Obart. So some varieties, in this case, Australian English, don't have the H dropping for whatever reason. Yeah? Okay, let's go on and look at more stuff to do with the sociolinguistics of society rather than the sociolinguistics of language by itself. And the first topic we want to look at is the difference between a language and a dialect. And the traditional view is that different dialects of a single language are mutually comprehensible, whereas different separate languages, different languages are not mutually comprehensible. So clearly, British English and American English are mutually comprehensible. They have different accents, different spellings, and there are sometimes differences of vocabulary and misunderstanding. So, for example, in American English, wash up means have a wash, not do the dishes. So there are occasional misunderstandings, but clearly British and American English are mutually comprehensible. Whereas distinct languages, such as English and German, are not. You clearly can't understand a German speaker just on the basis of knowledge of English. But there is an alternative. Rather than saying that dialects are mutually comprehensible and languages aren't, there's an alternative description, which is attributed to the American linguist Max Weinreich, who said, "A language is a dialect with an army and a navy." So maybe there should be a navy in there. This is not to be interpreted literally. No one would suggest that British English and American English and Canadian English are different languages because they each have their own armed forces associated with them. The point is just to make the point that the distinction between a language and a dialect is as much a socio-political issue as a linguistic issue. So, for example, German still has a fairly robust system of different dialects, perhaps because Germany was unified fairly late, which are not mutually comprehensible at all, but they're all considered as dialects of German, and there's clearly a standard German, whereas the dialect of Cologne, for instance, is very different and not comprehensible to standard German speakers. What else am I going to talk about? The next thing I want to talk about with regard to... going back a little bit. Sticking to Weinreich and the languages of dialect stuff, for example, Danish, Norwegian and Swedish are pretty much mutually comprehensible, especially when spoken, but not so much when written, but they are seen as different languages because they each have a separate political entity associated with them. And as another example, the language that used to be referred to often as Serbo-Croat with a hyphen is now often referred to as two separate languages, Serbian and Croatian, because of the political developments in the former Yugoslavia. They've also written with different scripts, so this is the right way round. Serbian is written with the Cyrillic alphabet and Croatian with the Roman alphabet, so they are seen as different languages despite them being very similar to each other, certainly in terms of, in spoken terms. I want to talk a little bit now about one of the other things to do with the sociolinguistics of society, namely language planning. And just as an example, one of the reforms introduced by the Ataturk government in Turkey, Turkey, in the 1920s, was that the Arabic script for Turkish was replaced by the Roman alphabet. So Turkish is now written with the Roman alphabet plus a few extra accents and diacritics, having previously been written with the Arabic script, for example. In 1996, or from 96 onwards, there was a German spelling reform. Just want to look at a couple of examples of this. The first one, there were many other examples. This is just examples. So this is that in the sense of, I think that it will be a nice day tomorrow. Not that as in that's a good idea. The letter at the end of the first word is a special German letter called SZ, which has been not entirely, but to some extent done away with in the spelling reform. So it's been replaced here by the double S, thus pronounced the same, but spelled differently now. The second example, I think it's for clarity that the hyphen between the letters, between the numbers and the letters there, doesn't really change anything else. In English, the use of hyphens is a matter for style manuals and so on, but in Germany it was a ruling by the Ministry of Education because it was to be taught in schools. And as the last example, Radfahren, to ride a bike. Rad means bike, fahren means to ride or to drive. And it used to be written as a single word, just as if you wrote screen share in English, screen share as a single word. But after the reform, it's written as two separate words. And because in German, nouns begin with an initial capital letter, so Rad, meaning bike, was written with the initial capital. The main reason for this, I think, was consistency, because the expression Autofahren, to drive a car, was always written as two separate words with the capital A for Auto, meaning car. Some of the other issues to do with language planning are to do with things like the status of languages. So, for example, the status of Welsh in Wales, the status of sign language, the status of Braille, what expectations do people have, or what are people entitled to have sign language and Braille and so on available to them. And, for example, last year, Parliament passed the British Sign Language Act, which gives official recognition to the status of British Sign Language in England, Wales and Scotland, not Northern Ireland for some reason. I don't know what the actual impact of that has been in practice, but that's what's now in law. And also in the UK, there are now language requirements for migrants, certainly for people wanting to come to the UK on skilled worker visas. They have to show a particular level of English before they can get a visa of that type. Yeah. And as another example, something I saw recently in terms of language planning, language status, in Inner Mongolia, which is officially an autonomous region of China, it's now been decided that all school lessons will be taught in Chinese rather than in Mongolian. I guess that previously people were, Chinese was taught in schools, but now Chinese will be the language of instruction rather than Mongolian. Okay, last topic I want to look at is the links between language and thought. I think I'll be briefer here than I was on language and society. I think probably all agree that the terminology people use can sometimes affect the way people understand things. So if you talk about, if you call some people rebels or freedom fighters or terrorists, the terms you use may influence how people react to them. And also I did see once that the term global warming was originally coined because it was meant to be more benign than climate change, although that may have rather gone a bit wrong over the time, over the years. Yeah. Okay, I want to look at one specific theory about language and thought, namely what is linguistic relativity. This claims that our native language influences or determines the way we interpret the world. As you can maybe see from the way that's been worded, there are different versions of this which make rather different claims, and that's one of the problems with it. But our native language influences or determines the way you interpret the world. And this is often called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, after the names of the two American linguists who originally proposed it. And Sapir, for example, wrote that we see and hear and otherwise experience very largely we do because the language habits of our community predispose certain choices of interpretation. I'm not sure that Sapir actually said very much about linguistic relativity, but he certainly said a bit about it. The person who did write a lot more about linguistic relativity was Benjamin Wolfe. He said, Newtonian concepts of space, time and matter are recepts from culture and language. A recept, by the way, is a mental image formed by repeated exposure to a stimulus. So when we hear words like space and time, whatever, maybe that's what influences the way we think of things. Now, your reaction to that may well be, sounds like nonsense, and I'd probably agree with you. Wolf did write a lot of stuff on linguistic relativity. And most of what I've read of it is really very unconvincing. He just assumes what he wants to prove rather than anything else. And also, for example, he spent a lot of time comparing what he called standard average European, that's to say most European languages, with the Native American language Hopi. But much of what he said about Hopi is simply wrong at the most basic factual level. So, for example, he claimed that Hopi has no expressions referring to time, and that's simply not the case. And it may well be that the person he used as a consultant wasn't really a fluent speaker of Hopi. So I think you can dismiss, personally, I think you can dismiss what Wolf said about this. But that doesn't in itself mean that that the whole idea is complete nonsense. And there has been quite a lot of work since Wolf's time in the first half of the last century trying to test these rather vague claims. And one topic, I'm not going to look at it in detail, but just mention it, is different colour terms. Languages differ in the kind of colour terminology they have. And it's been claimed that that a language's colour terminology affects not so much whether people can distinguish different shades of different colours, but whether they actually do so in practice in terms of naming things, so whether they really distinguish strictly between blue and green or red and yellow or something like that. What I'm going to do instead is to talk about directional terms. And in English and in most languages, directional terms are egocentric. That's to say, they relate to the speaker or to some other person in the situation. So if I say the lamp is to the left of the table, then that means it's from there, from the way I'm looking at it. If I say the lamp is in front of the table, then it's in front in terms of the way I'm looking at it. I mean, if I say to somebody else, giving them directions, go past Tesco and turn left, then that's from their point of view. It's egocentric from that point of view. But there are some languages which use geographic directions rather than egocentric directions. So instead of saying turn left, people will actually say turn north or turn northeast. And these don't have to be necessarily precisely to do with compass north, but close enough anyway, yeah? And I'm going to, this all sounds very weird, yeah? But it does imply in some languages. And those I'm going to look at is the Australian language, this language's main claim to fame is it's the origin of the word kangaroo, but that's not what I'm going to talk about now. Naga is the word for east, and that expression naga naga banayi means move a bit to the east. You can't have a talk on linguistics without at least one example from a quote-unquote exotic language. So that's taken care of now. So where you and I would say, move a bit to your left, a Gugu Yimithe speaker would say, move a bit to the east. And speakers have, in terms of one of the sources I used, quotes, perfect pitch for directions. If I were to ask you, where is north from where you're sitting now? I'm willing to bet that most of you wouldn't be able to answer straight away. I mean, if you thought about it, you wouldn't be absolutely certain that you could really point towards north. But speakers of languages with geographic directions, such as Gugu Yimithe, really do know. They have perfect awareness of directions and so on. And there's a story of one anthropologist, I think, who was studying speakers of Gugu Yimithe or some other Australian language, and he asked one speaker where certain goods were in the local shop. And you and I would say, well, you go in and it's on the left. But this speaker answered, you go in and it's to the northeast, which wasn't necessarily the most helpful way of phrasing it. I should say that what is being said about Gugu Yimithe now really applies to a previous generation speakers. The language is on its last legs now and not really being passed on very accurately to younger people. But what is said is sort of accurate enough, what is accurate for a generation or two ago. So Gugu Yimithe speakers don't have words like left or in front. They say east, northeast, etc. It's been claimed that their language is responsible for this. The language has the words for north, but it doesn't have words for left, right, in front of, and so on and so on. I'm always very dubious about this linguistic relativity stuff, and I only don't think it's anywhere near as pervasive as people like Wolf claim. But if there is any validity for it, it's very restricted things like directions and so on. Okay. I've almost finished now, but before I do finish, I want to go back to something I said right at the beginning. Remember pin, okay? The P of pin also contrasts with the T of tin. So if you say tin, your tongue is just behind your teeth, on the ridge behind your teeth, yeah? So the P of pin is produced with the lips, the T of tin is produced with the ridge behind your teeth, yeah? Now think not about pin, but about bin, the B of bin. That's also produced with your lips, yeah? There's no need to unmute for this, what's coming up. Just think about it for yourself, yeah? So the P of pin is aspirated. Is the B of bin aspirated? It probably isn't, is it, bin? The T of tin is tin, but bin isn't aspirated, yeah? However, the P and the B differ in that respect. but they differ in another respect too. You can discover this if you put your fingers on your Adam's apple. Now, that will be easier for some of you than for others. Nevertheless, if you don't pronounce the whole word, just say P and then B. And when you say the B, you should feel something going on in your throat. Yeah? And that is your vocal cords vibrating. And the B sound is a voiced sound. The P, a pin, is a voiceless sound. Yeah? So P and B differ in terms of voicing as well as in terms of aspiration. Yeah? If you put your fingers on your throat again and say pin, then you hopefully you can feel that though the P is voiceless, the other sounds in that word are voiced. So generally in English, vowels are voiced. Yeah, whispering is generally voiceless. Yeah, which is why it's harder to hear over any kind of distance. Yeah. So now you know how to discover whether a sound is aspirated or not, and whether it's voiceless or not. It's best not to do this kind of thing in public because you tend to get rather odd looks. However, I can tell you that you will be tested on this at the Autumn Delegate meeting. And in case you don't believe me, I would remind you that I'm doing the agenda. So they will be on the agenda. Okay, that's the end of the talk. Thank you.